Morning, everybody. On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Hillary Clinton begins her general election rollout today as the Democrats gather in Philadelphia. By Thursday night, she'll lose the word presumptive from her moniker, and she'll lose the head of the Democratic National Committee when Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigns amid scandal. On Wednesday, Tim Kaine gets his chance to introduce himself to the country, and President Obama will take the first step in his exit from the political stage. Bernie Sanders gets a high-profile slot tonight. This morning, a preview of the Democratic Convention with Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland and Michael Higginbotham from University of Baltimore School of Law. Then, Living Questions, our religion series, continues with Rabbi Jesse Gross, who's recently been named one of America's most inspiring rabbis. She'll introduce us to the Charm City Tribe. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Spamalot at Cockpit in Court. Nathan's got the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. It is Maryland Morning on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend, and we are glad you're with us. CNN and Opinion Research released a poll just this morning showing a significant Trump bump following what many considered a Republican convention that was riddled with mishaps and divisiveness. The Democrats get underway today in Philadelphia, and they are not without their share of divisive issues as well. Yesterday, Debbie Wasserman Schultz announced her intention to resign as chair of the Democratic National Committee when the convention concludes on Thursday following a WikiLeaks release of 20,000 emails revealing that staffers at the DNC worked to thwart the nomination of Bernie Sanders. Pro-Sanders demonstrations on the streets of Philadelphia yesterday were sizable. Senator Sanders is scheduled to address the convention tonight. If the Republican convention laid bare deep fissures in the GOP, are there Democrats who are also struggling to find the soul of their party? Are Secretary Clinton's efforts to unite the moderate and progressive wings of the party helped or hindered by choosing Tim Kaine as her running mate? Is the expected endorsement from former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg a significant development? And what does it portend as the campaign continues? As we did with the Republican convention last week, we'll spend a good bit of each show this week talking about the Democrats' gathering in Philadelphia. This morning, my guests are Dr. Sherry Parks. She's an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she also is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. Michael Higginbotham joins us as well. He's the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law and the former interim dean at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Good morning to you both. Always good to see you.
Good morning.
Good to be with you.
So, Sherry, what is this about the Democrats and emails? It's amazing how much trouble they've managed to get themselves in regarding emails. I mean, this business with Debbie Wasserman Schultz this huge trove of emails in which Ms. Schultz herself, and well as many other senior staffers at the DNC, clearly interested in favoring Secretary Clinton over Senator Sanders, really from the get-go, giving some credence, no small measure of credence, to what Donald Trump and others have been saying, including Senator Sanders, that this thing was rigged from the start. What do you make of it?
Well, I definitely think it gives some credence to the idea that the system is rigged. And it's an interesting statement that some people still think that their emails are private. That comes with a certain level of privilege, that you assume that something is filtering and blocking your emails. And I think we're beginning to see that people with a great deal of privilege are having the same level of surveillance that the poor have always had, and that privilege, that core experience that's protected by the way we think of the public sphere, that is all out in public while there's really some private conversations going on inside, is beginning to unravel.
Yeah. And Mike Higginbotham, when you read emails like that, when folks are questioning Senator Sanders' religion and these kinds of things, Donald Trump is considered by so many in the Democratic Party to be literally dangerous. I mean, not just an extremist, but a dangerous extremist. The Washington Post had an extraordinary opinion piece this weekend in which they said, there's just no way we're going to endorse him, and we're going to let people know that here in July. We're not going to wait until November to tell folks about it. Does it give credence to Mr. Trump's assertions that the system is rigged?
Well, you know, this has been a long-term concern in the Democratic Party. Many of the Sanders supporters had some concerns about objectivity, lack of objectivity with respect to the DNC chair. So this has been going on for about 6 months now. And I think, you know, really, the referee has to be neutral. Certainly these emails are very, very concerning about a lack of neutrality. And clearly, I think, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz needs to go. And I think she needs to go sooner rather than later.
It's interesting that she's going to be in front of the convention, and you got to wonder how that's going to work
out for
her.
That's a mistake. I think that's a real mistake.
I do too.
And, you know, she should go now immediately. And I think it's really important for, you know, the Sanders supporters to see that because it's important for the Democrats to unite. It really is. And it's very important for Clinton, I think, to demonstrate that this is unacceptable and to send a message to Bernie Sanders that, hey, you know, we need to unite now.
Even her staying on, I think, lends credence to the idea that it's rigged because some observers are saying this is out of personal loyalty between the Clintons and her, that they're putting their loyalty to her over the well-being of the party. That is the essence of being rigged, that these relationships, these private relationships are more important.
Mm-hmm. Back in March, I mean, this has been brewing for a while. Back in March, a congresswoman from Hawaii, Tulsi Gabbard, resigned as the associate the vice chair of the DNC because she wanted to support Senator Sanders, and she identified the crux of her support because she thought that Secretary Clinton would be more inclined to intervention in the Middle East in particular. She is a military veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she said, you know, based on that experience, I want a commander-in-chief who's going to be less likely to intervene in the Middle East. There were sizable, by all reports, demonstrations, pro-Sanders demonstrations last night and yesterday in Philadelphia, along with demonstrations on issues like the environment and others. Senator Sanders makes his big address tonight, and people are looking to that, Mike Higginbotham, as one of the real central moments of this campaign right off the bat.
I think it's very important what Senator Sanders says tonight. I think all eyes will be watching. Very important that he gets behind Clinton, but also very important that messages are sent to him and his supporters, because I think he's already clearly endorsed her. I saw him on Meet the Press yesterday, and he, you know, clearly he has endorsed her. He's supporting her, but he needs to make sure that his supporters are also enthusiastic.
Sherry Parks, is this an opening for folks like Jill Stein, who's the Green Party candidate, who is, according to the CNN poll this morning, is polling at 3%. Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, polling at about 9%. I mean, they're still way, way down there. But is this a situation that's ripe for a third party play?
Maybe, but not in the long run. I mean, certainly there's symbolic importance to it. The idea that the two-party system is rigged and there should be fresh voices is something that is going to take a long time to build. I don't think it's going to matter much for this election, but it may work if the media then turn to them as another fresh voice. I think that's an important step that may or may not happen.
Gail Collins wrote in the Times over the weekend that Hillary Clinton is the one person who made the idea of a woman becoming president so normal that many young women are bored by it. That's interesting. When we talk about the age gap, the age gap between women who support Mrs. Clinton and people, young women who don't, it's really quite fascinating. We are at a very historic moment, and with all this, you know, kerfluffle going around the sides, it's easy to forget that on Thursday night, a major political party is going to nominate the first woman almost 100 years after Mrs. Stanton and the revolution that began, you know, last century. What is it about Hillary Clinton and a generation that can't seem to warm up to her?
I'm really not sure. I'm really concerned that, you know, all of this controversy will allow people to forget the significance of what is really happening. And it is significant. It's a big deal. I mean, Hillary Clinton will be the first nominee of a major party who's female. And when you look at, you know, the arc of the moral universe and justice, clearly this is a big deal in our history. And I think people need to recognize that. Whether she wins or loses the presidency, this is a big deal. As Barack Obama's nomination was a big deal in the Democratic Party as the first African American nominated from a major party.
Yeah, two historic nominations in a row, Sherry Park.
Well, and I think it's interesting that they come in this block. I think it says something about how we feel about the presidency. I think there are two things going on. Many other countries have had female leaders, and we're kind of used to it, of seeing them in the news and talking, and the United States has been far behind. I think another thing that's going on, why the large feminist core is not really backing her, is that Hillary is a second-wave feminist. In a way, she has to be to run for president. A second-wave feminist is really trying to occupy the space of masculinity. Many young feminists, particularly those who are supporting Sanders, are third-wave feminists, where a second-wave feminist looks old, looks dated. And she in her pantsuits, notice she's trying to dress in a more traditionally feminine way after we've seen in England the leader was, her shoes became important in terms of how people begin to appreciate her. I think there's a disconnect between the people who we think would be supporting Hillary and the way she presents herself.
So I dig down on that a little bit. Okay. Occupying a space of masculinity. What does that mean?
Think about what the presidency is. The president has generally been dad. He is the person, and they all have been he, so I'm not being politically incorrect here. They have been the people who we think of as leaders, as figureheads, who take us into wars or take us out of trouble. And the behaviors that are, I mean, think of Trump. The behaviors that are being appreciated by him are very masculinized, that he's pushy, that he's even a little, I think, more than a little mean. And that is a very masculine space. And that someone can come and say, and this is a problem for the Democrats, that they've got to show heart. They've got to show caring. And that's what the Cain selection suggests. But Hillary can't do very much of that, or she'll be slammed for being too much of a woman, not presidential. Third-wave feminists have embraced the allness, that they get to be masculine and feminine, that this is not a one or other dichotomy.
All right, we are going to continue with this conversation after a break for the news. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean at the University of Maryland College Park, where she teaches in the Department of American Studies. Her latest book is called Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. Professor Michael Higginbotham teaches law at the University of Baltimore Law School. He's the author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. More on presidential politics after a break for the news. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Hillary Clinton, as an inept negotiator of the worst nuclear arms deal in American history, is she guilty or not guilty? Next. Oh, believe me, we're not done yet. The indictment is hardly complete.
Chris Christie holding a mock inquisition of Hillary Clinton at the Republican convention last week in Cleveland. If you're just joining us here on Maryland Morning, we're looking back at the Republican convention in Cleveland and looking ahead to the Democratic convention, which begins today in Philadelphia. I'm Tom Hall. Joining me this morning in Studio A, Dr. Sherry Parks, an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she teaches in the Department of American Study. Her latest book is a good one. It's called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Michael Higginbotham is the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law and former interim dean at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's also the author of a terrific book, The Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. So, Mike Higginbotham, we hear Chris Christie holding this little mock inquisition that's kind of like right out of K Candide or something. It was kind of a little bizarre. But will the criticism of Hillary Rodham Clinton stick, either about her trustworthiness or about her activity as, you know, Secretary of State?
Well, I certainly think it's an argument that the Republicans continue to make, and I think that it highlights one of the problems that the Republicans are going to have, because it seems what unites the Republicans is a dislike for Hillary. And what needs to occur, and what Trump hasn't done yet, and I think if he doesn't do it, it's going to really hurt him, is to articulate a vision that can unite the Republicans. And he hasn't done that with any specificity except to say, you know, make America great again. And nobody, I think, understands what that means. And so unless Trump articulates that, I don't think he's going to expand his base, which is what he really needs to do if he wants to win.
And Sherry Parks, can't the same thing in a way be said of the Democrats, in that one of the things that unites them in a particularly divisive year between the progressive wing and the moderate wing of the Democratic Party is their distaste for Donald Trump?
I think you can say that. I think the difference is fear. I think there are people who are really very afraid of the election of Donald Trump. It was interesting that after the Republican National Convention, there was no upturn. Generally, they have the City on the Hill Morning in America message, doom and gloom, and then I am the answer. It was I am the answer, but there was no hope. There was no mourning aspect. I think it's strategically it's important that the Democrats have the last convention, because they can do the upswing. And I really do think that that's at the bottom of the selection of Kane. Everyone says he's a nice guy, and he may occupy that more soulful, caring space that Hillary has not been able to do.
So what's the crux then, Sherry, of the argument against Trump? I mean, is it for Secretary Clinton to prove that she's likable? I mean, that seems like a really difficult thing. If you've just sort of decided that somebody's a rotten person, how do you get that person to decide you're unrotten?
Well, unrotten and trustworthy. She's got both of those, because as long as that email kind of taint, and even having a new scandal has the word email is unfortunate for her camp. She's got to be presidential, because Donald Trump is not presidential. She's got to be the one that you want to have their finger next to the nuclear button, the one who will lead the country into the future. And in a way, it is a contest between the refrain of the Republican National Convention was, again, we want to be great again, we want to be safe again, even the image of Bob Dole.
And the refrain was, as we just heard, lock her up, too.
Well, but also the idea that let's return to the past. And if the Democrats, and they've already tried to do this, but they haven't hit it hard enough, I think, that who do you want not to return to the past? Because for her core, for instance, for African Americans, we don't want to go back to 1950. And that's true of many other people in her core, that who do you want to lead you into the future, I think, has to be her message.
And Mike Higginbotham, you're an attorney. You know the Constitution. You know a lot about the law. When you heard FBI Director James Comey announce his intention not to indict Secretary Clinton over the email, the use of a private server in her home, What did you hear? There was a legalistic argument, but there was also a sort of practical argument that he made, which is, turning out to be quite damning, frankly, that you know, she was acting in an inappropriate way, but it didn't appear to meet the level of criminality that it would take to actually prosecute.
Yeah, I think I give the FBI director a lot of credit. I think, he maintained his integrity, but he was very clear. She didn't break the law, but she really was unwise in her choices. And so I think he was very clear about that. I think it was the right thing to do from a legal standpoint, as well as, a wise decision of the director of the FBI, because he was in a difficult situation, no question about it. You have, a person who's about to be the nominee of the Democratic Party for the presidency, and you have the FBI having to investigate this and basically could decide the election. Because if Comey had come out and said, look, this is illegal, she needs to be indicted, certainly I don't think she'd be nominated this week.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that she hasn't been indicted hasn't stopped the Trump campaign from referring to her. I mean, Mr. Trump called them terrible, terrible crimes in his acceptance speech last Thursday. There haven't been any crimes, recognized by the legal system. But that's not going to stop people from assuming the crimes were, in fact, committed.
And I think what the American people have to do is make a judgment about what they think in terms of Hillary Clinton's judgment. Does this judgment that she exercised, does that mean that she should not be qualified to be president and therefore people shouldn't vote for her? Or is this something that, you know, she made a mistake, but she's still qualified to be president?
Sherry Parks, what does it tell you about the people who are surrounding Secretary Clinton, the kinds of people she has working for her, that nobody seems to have stepped up and said, Madam Secretary, this is a rotten idea. Don't do this.
Right. I mean, and there is some evidence that some people did say that. And that's the more damning evidence, that people said maybe we shouldn't do this. But what they also have not done is to question whether she's being judged by a different standard, that secretaries of state have done what she has done for at least the last several administrations. And yet they were not called out in the way she's being called out. Was it not wise? Of course it was not wise. But she was following the path of Colin Powell and other people.
Who yeah, but did Colin Powell have a private server in the basement of his house?
He used private email, yes.
Yeah, but that's different. It's a little. There is a difference in degree, I think, of what they're identifying Secretary Clinton of having done here. And also the way she handled this. I mean, the way she was very reluctant to talk about it at all in the beginning. She's made some statements that appear to be patently false about, you know, whether or not there was classified information transferred in these private emails. How does she get around that? I mean, if they're calling her Crooked Hillary on the right, how does she respond to that in the context of this determination by the FBI?
Well, and I think it was interesting the way Donna Brazile handled the scandal right now, is that Donna Brazile came out on media, who's now the interim head of the DNC,
right,
said, yes, this was a problem. We did it. Let's move on. I think Hillary should have done that earlier on and let it drag out. Anytime you let it drag out, it gets bigger and bigger. And the fact that her people didn't advise her to do that at the very beginning so that they could move on is a problem.
Yeah, yeah. And Mike Higginbotham, the choice of Tim Kaine, is there a way of that choice being used to appease and, in fact, animate and excite the progressive wing in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think they're trying to do that. Certainly, Tim Kaine is not from that wing of the party. He is a moderate Democrat. His record indicates that. Although, you know, clearly he's an excellent choice in terms of his experience, in terms of his character, and in terms of his dedication. So I think he's a good choice. But in terms of appeasing the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, this is not going to do that. Clinton needs to do it in other ways, and she needs to do it with policy. I think if you look at the platform, clearly that's been done, and that's why Bernie Sanders can enthusiastically embrace Clinton, because the convention platform really reflects a great deal of what Bernie Sanders was running on in the primaries.
Sherry Parks, there's a professor at Princeton University named Nell Irvin Painter. And she says that a Trump candidacy is not possible without the vitriolic reaction people had to Obama's election as president, that there was this negative reaction to President Obama that led to him and sort of made possible a candidacy of a person who's as extreme, excuse me, as Donald Trump. what do you think? I mean, and do you think the same could be said that nominating a woman, Hillary Rodham Clinton, wouldn't be possible without the historic precedent-breaking election of Barack Obama?
Well, I think there are two different ideas there, that I think, yes, that Obama opens up the avenues for other types of candidates, for it not to be a white male for the first time. I think we're further down the road on the hatred path, that Donald Trump has emboldened people who would have been silent and have been silent for a long time. And we have yet to see what that means. We know what it means in terms of giving. They're not in a position to give large amounts of money. And the people who have given large amounts of money before are backing off. Whether or not they'll show up to vote when they haven't shown up to vote before, we have to see.
Yeah. We got to get the Democrats have to get people energized one way or the other. Are you looking for a kumbaya moment, Mike Higginbotham? We just got a few seconds left. Is there going to be a kumbaya moment Thursday night?
Absolutely.
You think so?
You will see it. In fact, you will see on that stage over the next couple of days, you'll see some, you know, superstar Democrats holding hands, hugging, and you're going to get President Obama.
No former soap stars in this one.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Well, thanks to you both. We will have you back soon to continue the conversation. Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland College Park. Her latest book is called Fierce Angels. She is on the faculty, as I said, at University of Maryland College Park in the Department of American Studies. Mike Higginbotham teaches law at the University of Baltimore Law School. He's the author of Ghosts of Jim Crow. We'll continue our look at the Democratic Convention on Wednesday and Friday here on Maryland Morning with Farai Chidea of 538 and Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated, plus reporters on the ground in Philadelphia. Stay tuned for complete coverage of the convention this week with NPR and PBS. Joint coverage begins at 8 o'clock right here on 88.1 WYPR tonight. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots ahead. Stay with us. It's Monday morning. That means it's time to check in with our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Judy, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
So you have been out to Cockpit in Court's production of Spamalot. It's up there at the Essex campus of the Community College of Baltimore County. This is, of course, the famous Monty Python creation, the great comedy troupe. Spam, of course, is one of those words that has taken on all sorts of meanings, at least during our lifetimes. It was first a very horrible meat, and now it's stuff you don't want to have in your inbox. So what about this show? Is this spam, as we have come to know this, or is it the real deal?
No, this is very much the real deal. In fact, Tom, it's one of the best productions that I've seen at Cockpit and Court. The director, Laurie Sentman Starkey, and her cast really capture that wacky Python sensibility. The show is adapted by Python's Eric Idle from their 1975 movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And in most respects, it's loyal to the movie. For example, anyone who's on horseback, there are no horses on stage. There were no horses in the movie. Instead, coconut halves are clicked together to sound like hooves, and I'm sure you remember the number, He's Not Dead Yet.
I do indeed.
Camelot turns out to be a lot like Las Vegas in the stage show, and the stage show also fleshes out a character who's just a passing reference in the movie, the Lady of the Lake. She's the one who tells Arthur that he will one day be king. And on stage, the Lady of the Lake has her own chorus girls, and they are called, of course, Laker girls.
Laker girls, yeah, got it.
And
got it.
The knights are given an additional task, and that is to put on a Broadway show.
That's it. You know, if you're going to have some knights, you might as well put on a show. Of course, you know, since the 70s, when I fell in love with Monty Python and their great TV show on the BBC, they've held nothing sacred. I mean, Spamalot really is just completely irreverent and beautifully so, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that spirit informs the musical from start to finish. You probably remember that the story spoofs King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Arthur is very well played here by Phil Gallagher, and he enlists the various knights for his round table, and then they go on the quest for the Holy Grail. The show is also, as the movie was, irreverent towards religion. God sends them to find the Holy Grail, and he's represented by a pair of giant two-dimensional legs that descend from the flies. The show is even irreverent towards Broadway musicals. It spoofs Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera and Fiddler on the Roof and Peter Allen, and there's even an added line about Hamilton. What it is reverent about is the movie, although the ending here is different. But it has several songs from the movie and one that it borrows from another Python movie, Life of Brian. I'm sure you remember that one, the song, of course. Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. It's sung by Arthur's servant, Patsy. Gary Dieter plays him in the Cockpit production, the royal servant of the king, and he's, I think, the best performance in the show. He sings that song with this kind of goofy glee, and he's joined by a tap dancing chorus twirling yellow umbrellas, and let's listen to a bit of that.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
All right, Gary Dieter singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life from Cockpit and Court's production of Spamalot. What a great song and what a great scene in Life of
Brian.
And
a great philosophy.
Indeed. Nothing wrong with that philosophy at all. By the way, are there more songs in the stage musical than there were in the movie, in the first movie?
Oh, absolutely. It has a score by Eric Idle and John Dupre. One of the funniest new songs is called The Song That Goes Like This, and it is basically the show spoofing itself. This is also the number that includes the Phantom of the Opera spoof. It has that Andrew Lloyd Webber style of over-emoting. I brought you a clip. It's sung by Eileen Keenan as a very diva-like Lady of the Lake and David Jennings as Sir Galahad.
Oh, where is the song that goes like this? Sentimental song that casts a magic spell. They all will hum along. We'll overact like hell.
Yeah, that's right. Overact like hell, indeed. So that's David Jennings and Eileen Keenan in Cockpit and Court's production of Spamalot, Knights and Laker Girls. I like that touch. This is actually a pretty big musical. I mean, Cockpit's not a huge theater. How did it handle it?
It is very big. It has a big cast. It has lots of costumes. There's a giant Trojan rabbit. That's the Python's version of the Trojan horse.
What show would be complete without a Trojan rabbit?
Exactly.
Right?
Some of the scene changes are a little slow, and one effect, the Black Knight, doesn't quite work. It didn't quite work on Broadway either. There are lots and lots of production numbers. It has very, very strong choreography by Amanda Dixon, from cheerleading to mariachi to a spoof on the bottle dance from Fiddler. Everything's in there. So it's a great dose of summer silliness, and I thought that I would take us out with the number that is sung in the Las Vegas-style Camelot.
All right, Spamalot is at Cockpit in Court on the Essex campus of Community College of Baltimore County. It's there through next weekend. We'll have complete details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Judy Russick, always a pleasure. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Tom.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for news, our next installment in our series, Living Questions, examining the role of religion in the public sphere. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan, and welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. It's time now for another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. My guest this morning is Rabbi Jessie Gross. She's the Senior Director of Jewish Life at the Baltimore Community Center and the founder of Charm City Tribe, a group of Jewish millennials. Rabbi Gross, it's nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations. You have been named by Forward Magazine as one of the 30-something inspiring rabbis in the United States. So that's really cool. Thank you and congratulations for that. Tell us about Charm City Tribe. This is an organization that you've put together that specifically targets young people here in Baltimore.
Yeah, so Charm City Tribe is a community effort for people in their 20s and 30s looking to tap into Jewish culture and tradition in creative and meaningful ways. It is a program housed in the Jewish Community Center and sponsored by the Associated, our local Jewish federation. And really, the initiative came out of a community study done in 2010, in which two key data findings led them to want to hire a rabbi outside of the Orthodox community to engage 20s and 30s living downtown. One is that more people are choosing to live and stay downtown in Baltimore than before, and most of the Jewish resources in town are concentrated a little bit out in the Pikesville Owings Mills corridor. But also that there's this astounding data point of folks between the ages of 18 and 34 who say that coming from Jewish tradition and being a part of the Jewish community is important to them. 55% of those surveyed that are not Orthodox, that are between the ages of 18 and 34, say being Jewish is important to them. But only 11% of those folks say that belonging to a synagogue or some sort of traditional affiliation is something that they think is important. So there's this either silent majority or sweet spot of 44% of folks who have positive associations are probably looking to connect, but not necessarily in the traditional manners. And so they put me in the trenches and put me on the ground, and we pop up in bars and coffee shops all over the town trying to engage people and see where they're at and see how we can parse out community and values and what it means for folks growing up at this stage in that generation.
And I guess this is not unique to Judaism, right? The religion in general, according to the Pew studies of religion in public life, say that, you know, fewer and fewer people are embracing the religion into which they were born, for example. I mean, this is something that a lot of religions are facing. What's your pitch to the millennials when they come to you and say, hey, I sort of have this interest, but, you know, I'm not really religious, but I'm spiritual. When you hear somebody say that, how do you respond?
Yeah, well, for me, I think that many people, especially growing up in the Jewish tradition, although I'm sure this is true in others, have a somewhat juvenile association of what it means to be a Jew in community, because many of them went to Hebrew school one or two times a week between the ages of 8 and 13 and look back on that pinnacle experience of bar mitzvah, which in Jewish tradition is supposed to be an on-ramp and has for many people been an off-ramp. And they memorized the prayers and the part of their Torah portion they needed to, and then they were out the door and we haven't seen them since. And so for me, it's about trying to close that gap between that experience many people might have had as a child, and then tap into some of those more universal connections that they might have vis-a-vis moral imperatives, values, even an association and connection to Jewish culture through the holiday cycle, and say, wow, it just actually gets good as an adult. If you limit your perception of what this is to the experience you had when your parents were dropping you off at Hebrew school a couple times a week, you haven't even scratched the surface. For me, I just try to spark them with curiosity and help them uncover. But to be clear, nobody usually comes up to me and says, hey, I'm looking for this. It's more a methodology of how we pop ourselves up in places that people tend to go to all the time and try to do what everyone, I think, is trying to do with this millennial generation, which is make a case that the tradition that feels age old and ancient is still relevant to a 27-year-old living in Baltimore City in 2016.
And the fact that you're physically meeting in person, that alone can be something of a unique phenomenon for folks who sometimes folks refer to them as the Amazon generation, where everything is done online. Your friends are on Facebook; they're not in your living room. You're actually, you know, the centrality of actually meeting each other and doing stuff together is really quite important. Right?
I actually think that's the most. That's the greatest value proposition we have to offer right now, right? We're in a values-driven market in an overarching society that's kind of driven by capitalism and the financial bottom line. So you have to figure out how to itch yourself in to the market in some way. For me, it's about being seen. We go to Facebook. We even show up at concerts. And sometimes people may not even feel like they're recognized, or if they didn't show up, that it would make a difference. And so in that case, I think that's the most important thing that we do. Our entire approach uses a community organizing model. And if you know, community organizing is about grassroots organizing for the sake of systemic change. Usually we see it play out in our political system, but I'm trained as a community organizer. I leverage community organizing in that relationships are essential. And thinking about what it means to meet people where they're at and then have some sense of strategy or idea for what it means to create momentum as a collective is at the essence of everything I try to do. Also, I used to joke for the first couple of years that I think the Jewish community hired me not just because of my knowledge of Torah, but I had a hip factor. And so often I say my previous kind of starting point for Charm City Tribe was I'm a little bit Torah teacher, a little bit event planner, and a little bit community organizer. And sometimes I think it's my success in the party planning to turn people out that gives people the opportunity to see what we can do once they're there.
Where does God fit into all of this? I mean, usually the on-ramp to religion is through prayer and through, you know, contemplation of the divine.
Totally. Well, God can be a really dirty word, which is interesting for a rabbi to say. I mean, I love that in Jewish tradition, a relationship between a person and the divine has always been an incredibly personal and individual thing, and yet at the same time inherently connected to the way that we leverage our relationships in community to make an impact in our society. So if someone wants to talk about God, I'd love to talk about God, and I have my own kind of touch points for what it is that I believe in. But I love that Judaism invites us to keep our relationship to God somewhat personal, but that the imperative to engage with each other in our society is a communal thing. And so I think that riffing off of that spiritual but not religious component can be the most important thing we do, because God may be somewhere along the way, but mostly I like to start with talking to people about where they come from, who they are, and what they're looking for. And I think the order matters.
Well, Rabbi Jesse Gross, it is great to meet you. Thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations on the acclamation from Forward Magazine.
Thanks so much.
Rabbi Jesse Gross is the Senior Director of Jewish Life, excuse me, at the Baltimore Jewish Community Center. She's the founder of Charm City Tribe, and she was recently named by a leading Jewish magazine, The Forward, as one of America's 32 inspiring rabbis. This has been another installment of Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in conjunction with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. You can hear this and all of the conversations in our Living Questions series. Plus, you can find a link to more information about the Charm City Tribe on our website, wypr.org/livingquestions. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, an update from the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. And Nathan Sterner will talk to John Racanelli of the National Aquarium about changes for the dolphins there. And our resident foodie, Sasha Wohlhandler, will talk about some salads with an international flair. Hope you can join us Wednesday morning from Maryland Morning. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.